My task tonight is to give an introduction to the book of Judges, as has been mentioned, but also to comment briefly on chapter 1:1 to 3:6. Now, I'll be following the notes fairly closely, except for, that from time to time I will be adding or subtracting. Now, Judges is a sequel to Joshua, as we know. The two books go together. But the two books are in marked contrast. Joshua is, in the main, a record of victorious progress, but Judges contains seven cycles of failure and recovery. The last cycle, however, is not complete, for Samuel only began to deliver Israel. That's found in chapter 13 and 5, and that's very important in the life of Samson. He only began. And so he's different from the others. He only began to deliver Israel. Now, the book covers a period of some 350 years, or some think it was somewhat less than that, from sometime after the death of Joshua until the death of Samson. There are 13 judges, 12 men and one woman. Abimelech, the usurper, is not called a judge. Now, the judges were in the first place deliverers, military conquerors, or at least that is true of a good number of them, perhaps not of all of them. And when we read that they judged Israel for a certain number of years, we mustn't think of them as judges in a court, such as we understand it, but they were rather leaders or rulers. And the ordinary judicial functions would be exercised by the elders and officers of each tribe and city. Now, Hebrews 11, 32 and 33, they're called men of faith, who out of weakness were made strong. That's a very important lesson from the book of Judges. They were men of faith, and out of weakness they were made strong. Now, a word concerning the authorship and date of the composition of the book. According to the Jewish Talmud, which was a collection of Jewish writings of the early Christian centuries, Judges was written by Samuel. We can't say that with any certainty. Gleason Archer, in his Old Testament introduction, after considering the historical data with some care, concluded that it was probably completed early in the reign of David, either by Samuel himself or by one of his disciples. And the time of writing, I believe, would be the 11th century B.C. Now, with regard to the purpose, I've given a quotation from the Zondervan Pictorial Bible Dictionary, and I might mention that that's a Bible dictionary that I wholeheartedly recommend. I have a number of Bible dictionaries at home. I've just had this one for a few years, and now I have the habit of consulting it first. And mostly, I don't have to consult any others. Sometimes I do, but mostly I get just what I want in that Zondervan Pictorial Bible Dictionary. What is that you say?
Get a good stocking.
Get a good stocking, yes. It's very, very good. Very, very good indeed. Well, what is the purpose? Now, 3 points to mention. To bridge the gulf between the death of Joshua and the monarchy, or at least the events which led up to the monarchy. To show how prone the people of Israel were to turn from God, and to show their need for unity and leadership in the person of a king. Now, I've incorporated in the notes an instructive outline of the age of the Judges and the Book of Judges from Dr. Scroggie's book, The Unfolding Drama of Redemption. I think it's very instructive indeed. I'll just make 2 comments on it. If you were to add up the years of servitude in that outline, you'd find that they come to 114, and the years of rest to 296, making a total of 410. Which reminds us that the period is not one of total darkness. I think that's important. We get the idea sometimes that it's darkness right through. But if you just take those figures that are given, you'll find the years of rest were much more than the years of darkness. Think, for example, of the book of Ruth. It's not all darkness. It's not all darkness in the book of Ruth. Now, there's a problem with the chronology. Now, chronology is not one of my hobbies. I don't study it except when I'm forced to. But some of you may be keen on it. I've got, some years ago I was given a very wonderful book on chronology by Anstey, but I think I've hardly opened it. That's just a little confession. It's not one of the subjects that I'm really very interested in. Well, in 1 Kings 6 and 1, it gives 480 years from the Exodus to the fourth year of Solomon's reign. And that makes the 410 years of Judges too long. Well, how can we explain the difference? Well, one explanation, for example, given by Archer in the introduction I've referred to, is that some of the periods of oppression in Judges overlapped. For example, from chapter 10:7, where it says, "The Lord sold Israel into the hands of the Philistines and into the hands of the people of Ammon," that Samson and Jephthah must have been almost contemporaneous, the two oppressions being in different parts of the country. Now, there's another explanation given by Sir Robert Anderson in his book, The Coming Prince. He argued that in the book of Judges, for five several periods, their national existence as Jehovah's people was in abeyance. And therefore, those years, 93 in all, were not counted. And so he was able to reconcile all the numbers on that assumption. And you'll find that explanation in a number of expositions of Joshua, especially the older ones. Well, I'll leave that to you to work out for yourselves. Personally, I'm more inclined to Archer's explanation. Well, now, the book of Judges is full of spiritual lessons, and I think that that's important for us for this weekend. Don't think you've come here just to get some history lessons. It wouldn't have been worth coming. It wouldn't have been worth coming if you've just come here to get some history lessons. We must study the history because the lessons are embodied in the history. But it's full of spiritual lessons. Now, to begin with, I wrote down a list of spiritual lessons from the book of Judges that I was going to include in the notes. But then I thought I might be stealing the thunder of the other speakers if I did that, and so I omitted them. But I would very specially recommend to you Gary Enrig's book, Hearts of Iron, Feet of Clay. Now, I read that book some years ago, and I reread it recently, and I recommend it very warmly to you. Now, Gary is a very interesting speaker, as those of you know who heard him when he was in Australia, and his book just reads like 22 of his addresses, 22 interesting addresses. And I'm sure it's no reflection on any of the speakers at this conference if I say you'll learn more. You'll have more spiritual lessons and challenges from Gary's 22 addresses than you'll get from our 6. All right, now we come to chapter 1. Now, after the death of Joshua. Now, I've not mentioned this in the notes, but these words present a problem. According to Dr. Scroggie, and others agree with him, from chapter 1:1 to chapter 2:10, it is retrospective. In other words, these things did not happen after the death of Joshua, but they happened before the death of Joshua. Well, Dr. Scroggie says that either the words refer to the whole book, or the text is corrupt and we should read after the death of Moses. But now, I'm not sure that he was right. Now, the words after the death of Joshua are very similar to the opening of the book of Joshua, where it says, after the death of Moses, the Lord spoke to Joshua. Now, plainly the words don't refer directly to the whole of the book. They refer to the next part of the verse. After the death of Moses, it came to pass that the Lord spoke to Joshua. And so I believe it is here. After the death of Joshua, it came to pass the children of Israel asked the Lord. The words are directly connected with the second part of the verse and with the following verses. And I understand that there's no evidence in any ancient version or manuscript that the proper reading should be after the death of Moses. Well, now it's a problem that the scholars discuss, and I've thought quite a lot about it, and I don't claim that I have all the answers, but I'll just make a few comments. Now, if, as Dr. Scroggie believed, all these things happened in the lifetime of Joshua, it's very strange that Joshua's name is not mentioned from chapter 1:2 to chapter 2:6. It's like telling the story of the Exodus without mentioning Moses. Imagine a person telling the story of the Exodus and not saying anything about Moses. But how could this the writer tell the things that happened in the book of Joshua without mentioning the name of Joshua? I think it's quite an impossibility. And here too you find the tribes acting independently. Independently, each one. But in Joshua, they don't act independently. In Joshua chapter 10, you read six times the expression, Joshua and all Israel with him. They're not acting independently in the book of Joshua as they are acting here. Now, I admit that there are some things in this chapter that are also mentioned in the book of Joshua. For example, the beautiful story of Othniel, verses 12 to 15. Othniel and Aksa is found in Joshua chapter 15. But it doesn't necessarily follow that it happened in the lifetime of Joshua. He may be just reflecting back, but it is not necessarily so. Joshua's own burial is recorded in the book of Joshua, and surely that didn't happen in his lifetime. So it's therefore plain that another hand than Joshua's put the book in its final form. And he may have gone beyond Joshua's lifetime in other sections as well. And then there are things in the chapter that are not mentioned in Joshua, such as the story of Adonai Bezek, verses 5 to 7. There are additions to the record of Joshua, such as the burning of Jerusalem. May I suggest that what you have here is this, that the writer begins by telling us of certain events that took place after the death of Joshua, and then he proceeds to describe the conditions that existed after his death. And some of those conditions are linked with events in Joshua's time, events which had persisted after his death. For example, just before his death, in chapter 23:5, Joshua said that the Lord would drive out the remaining nations. But it hadn't happened. It hadn't happened because of the people's unfaithfulness. Anyhow, that's just a little, what some people call a critical discussion. Some may be interested in it, some may not. It won't make much, it won't make any difference really to the spiritual understanding of the passage. All right, well now let us see what the lessons we can learn from this chapter. Now it's interesting to compare Judges 1:1 with Joshua 1:1. Here, as it says, after the death of Joshua, in Joshua it's after the death of Moses, after the death of Moses. And after the death of Moses, the Lord spoke to Joshua. You see, Moses had a successor, but Joshua had no real successor. There's no national leader now, so there's nobody to whom to speak. And so it's the tribes acting independently without any great leader. God encouraged Joshua. Verse 8 of Joshua 1 says this, "This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate in it day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success." And that accounts largely for the success in the book of Joshua, because Joshua was obedient to the law of God, but that law was disregarded in the book of Judges. It's also interesting to link Judges with the last two chapters of Joshua. Now, if we had the time, we could spend almost the whole time on that. The last two chapters of Joshua are closely linked with the book of Judges. There you find the old warrior speaking to the people. He tells them that the Lord will drive out the remaining nations, which of course didn't happen because of their unfaithfulness. He bids them do everything in the book of the law of Moses, which of course they didn't do. As I've said, the law was quite prominent in Joshua. We saw it in chapter 1:8. Then in chapter 8, you find that Joshua wrote on stones a copy of the law, and he read all the words of the people. It's not like that in Judges. In fact, the word law is not once mentioned in Judges, except in the expression father-in-law. That's according to Strong's Concordance. That's the only references to the law in the book of Judges, the fathers-in-law. The law of Moses is not mentioned once. All right, and Joshua warns them of the dangers of idolatry, of making marriages with the Canaanites. These are the very things they do. He had warned them about it. He bids them serve the Lord and put away foreign gods. He also made a covenant with them in Shechem. A covenant, as the context shows, that they would serve the Lord and have nothing to do with idols. That's all in the last two chapters of Joshua. And then you read of his death in the book of Joshua. And so now we come to Judges, and it says, after the death of Joshua. Now, it doesn't tell us how long after. Perhaps it wasn't long after. It's been suggested that the Canaanites took advantage of Joshua's death to recover lost territory. Also, the conquest had not been completed in Joshua's time. You learn that, for example, from Joshua 13:1, 23, 4, 5. It wasn't complete. And so we can imagine that the people were inspired by these final words of Joshua and also by his death to complete the task. And so it says, after the death of Joshua, they asked the Lord who should go up first against the Canaanites. They probably asked through the Urim and the Thummim. The Urim and the Thummim, they were the little objects in the high priest's breastplate by which the high priest was able to learn the mind of God. And the Lord said that Judah should go up first. Judah was to be the future kingly tribe, and he was to go up first. And then from verse 2 to verse 22, it's an almost unbroken record of the victories of Judah. The Lord was with Judah, it says in verse 19. Now, there's very much in the passage of interest, if we had time to look at it carefully. Many spiritual lessons to be learned. We see the fellowship between Judah and Simeon, the reference to Jerusalem in verse 8, the references to the mountains and valleys, or lowlands, in verses 9, 19, 34, and they would make a difference militarily. The reference to Hebron in verse 10, to Deba or Kirjath Sefer, the town of books, in verse 11, the beautiful story of Othniel and Aksar in verses 12 to 15, and you read of Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron, and three of the five Philistine cities in verse 18, the other two being Ashdod and Gath. There are two exceptions to the record of victory. In verse 6, you're told how they cut off the thumbs and big toes of Adonai Bezek. But this was a pagan custom. They were commanded to put to death. They weren't commanded to mutilate. And the other failure is in verse 19. They couldn't drive out the inhabitants of the lowland because they had chariots of iron. But Pharaoh had chariots. Pharaoh had chariots. They perished in the Red Sea in Exodus 14:28. And chapter 4 tells us, of Judges, tells us that Sisera had 900 chariots of iron. But verse 15 says that the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots. Joshua 17:18, Joshua said to the house of Joseph, "You shall drive out the Canaanites, though they have chariots of iron and are strong." The same promise surely applied to Judah. See, the real trouble was not the chariots of iron. The real trouble was the lack of faith. Now, we might compare the lack of faith of the 10 spies in Numbers 13 about the inhabitants of the land. They said, they're all of great stature. All of them, not a single small person in the whole land. They're all of great stature. And there are giants there, and we were just like grasshoppers. Do you remember what Joshua and Caleb said? They're bred for us. And so it was their lack of faith. But as I think of this, I say, who am I to criticize them? I think I would have been afraid of the chariots of iron too. All right, well now, from verse 21 to the end of the chapter, you have the other tribes. It's a record of incomplete conquest, of compromise and partial obedience. The only really bright spot is the capture of Bethel by the house of Joseph, for the Lord was with them. One or two things we might notice is Bethshean there. I draw your attention to Bethshean in verse 27 for the simple reason we have Bethshean down in Sydney. Bethshean means the house of quiet, the house of peace, house of rest, Bethshean. And there are references to tribute in verses 28, 30, 33, and 35, and that of course was a compromise. The reference to the tribe of Dan forced into the mountains, verse 34. And that's important later in relation to the tribe of Dan and their history that you read later on in the book. Now, it'd be interesting to take a map and just see where all these things fit in, but this evening we haven't time to do that. And so we'll pass on to chapter 2. Now, I'll read the first two verses of chapter 2. Then the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, "I led you up from Egypt and brought you to the land of which I swore to your fathers, and I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land, but you shall tear down their altars. But you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you done this?" Here we have the faithfulness of the covenant-keeping God and the unfaithfulness of the covenant-breaking people. Those are words from Gary Inrig's book. And so verse 1 says, then the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim. Now, I believe that this is a key verse for the book of Judges. The angel of the Lord coming up from Gilgal to Bochim. Gilgal is very prominent in the book of Joshua. It's mentioned 12 times. In chapter 4, we learn that the people encamped at Gilgal after they came up out of the Jordan. Verse 19. There they set up the 12 stones which they took out of the Jordan, which many regard as typically a picture of death and burial and resurrection. In chapter 5, we learn that the covenant of circumcision was renewed there in Gilgal. The place was called Gilgal. Gilgal means rolling. It was called Gilgal because the reproach of Egypt was there rolled away. Now, the expression "the reproach of Egypt" has been variously explained. I like the explanation given in the Wycliffe commentary better than others that I've read. It seems to me to fit in very well with the context. The writer says this: when by faith the people of Israel crossed into their promised land and showed their willingness to re-accept God's covenant terms by submitting to circumcision, then the shame of their idolatry and lustfulness stemming from Egypt, the reproach of Egypt, the shame of their idolatry and lustfulness stemming from Egypt, was finally rolled away. Except I put a question mark after the word "finally." It was rolled away, but not finally rolled away. Now we learn, too, that the commander of the Lord's army, whom I take to be the same as the angel of the Lord and none other than the Lord Jesus, appeared to them near Gilgal. It actually says in the text, near Jericho. But Gilgal was on the plain of Jericho, and so you could say that the angel of the Lord appeared to them at or just near Gilgal. So you see, Gilgal was rich in spiritual lessons and associations, but now the angel of the Lord comes up from Gilgal to Bochim. And the word Bochim means weeping. Now, it's not known where Bochim was. Some have said it was Bethel. Matthew Poole, an old commentator, suggested that it was no other than Shiloh, where it seems probable that the people were met together upon some solemn festival. As you read the book of Joshua, you find that to begin with, Gilgal was their headquarters, but then later on, they made Shiloh their headquarters and set up their tabernacle there. That's in chapter 18, verse 1. Or I wonder if it could have been at or near Shechem, where they renewed their covenant with the Lord. I suppose I can be allowed to have a guess as well as anybody else. And my guess is that it was at Shechem or near Shechem. It would seem to me very fitting, and that the angel should come from Gilgal to Shechem. You see, they were the first and the last places in the book of Joshua where they renewed their covenant. And so the angel of the Lord appears, and he says in effect something like this: I was with you in Gilgal, and at Gilgal you renewed the covenant and declared you were finished with the idolatry you learned at Egypt. And near Gilgal I took over the army to deliver Jericho and the whole of Canaan into your hands. And here at Shechem you have again renewed the covenant, but you have broken it. So I'll no longer drive out the inhabitants of the land before you. No wonder the people wept and called the place Bochim, weeping. And then verse 2, the angel of the Lord said, you have not obeyed my voice. And the lesson of this passage surely is that partial obedience is disobedience. Now you find a good illustration of that in 1 Samuel 15, verses 10 to 23. There you find that Saul was bidden to destroy the Amalekites, but he only partially obeyed. But in verse 19, Samuel said, why did you not obey the voice of the Lord? He had partially obeyed, but Samuel said he hadn't obeyed. In verse 20, Saul said, but I have obeyed. I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. But you see, his partial obedience was counted disobedience. And then in verse 22 you find Samuel saying, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams. But there are some exceptions to that general rule, and I think I should mention this. Sometimes in special circumstances, God's strict order can be modified in obedience to a higher order. For example, in 2 Chronicles 30, verses 18 to 20, you find that the strict order of the Passover was modified in order to express the unity of the people. In Matthew chapter 12, the Lord taught that the strict order of the Sabbath could be modified in the interest of humanity and the service of the Lord. But generally speaking, partial obedience is disobedience, and it requires spiritual discernment to know whether it's a true exception or whether we are simply being disobedient. Well, now, verse 3, what does it say? Therefore I also said, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall be thorns in your side, and their God shall be a snare to you. Now, they had been warned about this, but they had taken no notice. All right, now we come to the introduction, what I call the introduction. Now, chapter 1:1 to 2:5 I would call the preface. And the preface covers the period from sometime after the death of Joshua to the death of the elders who outlived Joshua. And the introduction, chapter 2:6 to 3:6, except for chapter 2:6 to 10, and covers the book of Judges, with the exception of the appendices. Now, verses 6 to 10 are almost the same as Joshua 24, 28, 31. I'll just read those verses, 6 to 10. Chapter 2, 6 to 10. And, or one version I have, a Jewish version, says now. Now. It's resuming the narrative from Joshua. Now. When Joshua had dismissed the people, the children of Israel went each to his own inheritance to possess the land. So the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord which he had done for Israel. Now Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died when he was 110 years old, and they buried him within the border of his inheritance at Timnath-Heres in the mountains of Ephraim on the north side of Mount Gaash. When all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them, who did not know the Lord nor the work which he had done for Israel. Now concerning these verses, Mr. Howley's commentary says this: the great leader is now formally ushered off the stage. Chapter 2, 6 to 10 ties Judges to the ending of Joshua and accounts for the change from a dominant conquest pattern to the pattern outlined in Judges 2, 11 to 23. Now in verse 10 we see the second or third generation. They did not know the Lord personally. They had not seen his works. It's been said that the first generation is godly, the second generation is orthodox, and the third generation worldly. Mind, it need not be so. It need not be so. It isn't always so, but sometimes it is so. And then from verse 11 to verse 19, we have a description of the cycle found again and again in Judges. Sin, servitude, supplication, salvation, and sin again. Those are the words taken from Dr. Scroggie. And then verse 11, the first part of verse 11 says, then the children of Israel did evil, or did the evil, in the sight of the Lord. Those words are found seven times in Judges, and it's the evil of idolatry. And the type of idolatry is mentioned at the end of verse 11 and in verse 12. It says, they served the Baals, and they forsook the Lord God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and they followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were all round about, and they bowed down to them. They provoked the Lord to anger. Verse 13, they forsook the Lord and served Baal and Ash, the Ashtoreths. Now, I think in the notes I put a note on Baal and Ashtoreth. Just in brief, Baal was the fertility god. He gave fertility to the family, to the crops, to the herds. The Baals or Baalim were the idols where he was worshipped. He was also the storm god who brought rain. And his rites were the rites connected with his worship were very licentious. Now Ashtoreth was the female counterpart of Baal, and the plural Ashtaroth corresponded to the Baals or Baalim. Now just imagine the people of Israel taking part in these idolatrous, licentious rites. The law of Moses forbade idolatry. Joshua, as we have seen, warned them against it, but they wouldn't hear. They wouldn't walk in God's ways, as Isaiah said. Now verse 14 says that the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel. He sold them into the hands of their enemies. Verse 16, the Lord raised up judges. Verse 17, they played the harlot or the prostitute with other gods. It's a common thought in the Old Testament. See, Jehovah was the husband, as it were, and to flirt with these other gods was a prostitution, fornication, so on. Now that's a common thought in the Old Testament prophets, especially in Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Hosea. And it says they turned away quickly from the way. It wasn't a gradual process. They turned away quickly. You find similar words in Exodus 32 and 8 concerning the people of Israel at the time of the golden calf. They turned away quickly. Verse 19 says they behaved more corruptly. It wasn't a mere repetition, cycle after cycle. They went lower and lower. And verses 20 to 23 and 3:1 tell us that the Lord will no longer drive out the nations, but he will leave them to test Israel. Chapter 3, verse 2 also says that he was to teach them war. Again, to quote Mr. Howley's commentary, the skills of war-making, although not always valued by Christian ethicists, were a necessary part of existence in a hostile environment. But we could also remember that war would test their faith in God. With Israel, it wasn't just a matter of military weapons. It was a matter of faith in God, as you have later on in the book of Judges, say, with Gideon. It wasn't just a matter of great battalions and that sort of thing. It would test their faith in God. Now, I ended the notes with the following words. It would be an interesting exercise to inquire who are the modern counterparts of the enemies mentioned in verses 3 and 5, that is, 3 and 5 of chapter 3. And what should we do to avoid being enslaved by them? Well, now that's for something for you to think about. I'll just make a few little comments upon it. Robert Chapman, that very saintly man, once wrote these words, "There is no fault in our character that the grace of God cannot cure. It becomes us, therefore, to give no quarter to the Canaanites." You see how he applied it? He applied the Canaanites to the faults in our character, and we should give no quarter to the Canaanites. Lancelot Andrews, who lived in the 16th and 17th centuries, and he wrote a famous book of devotions, and he wrote the following: "Defend me from pride, the Amorite; envy, the Hittite; wrath, the Perizzite; gluttony, the Girgashite; lasciviousness, the Hivite; the cares of life, the Canaanite; and slothfulness, the Jebusite." Now, I don't know how he was able to allot the various sins to the particular nations, but the idea is right. The idea is right. We must put to death the works of the flesh. And then there's a corporate application. A church historian once said this: "Tell me the prevailing sin in the world, and I will tell you the besetting sin of the church." Tell me the prevailing sin in the world, and I will tell you the besetting sin of the church. That's what you have in Judges. Think of Corinth. What was the prevailing sin in the city? Immorality, sexual immorality. What was the greatest danger to the church? Immorality. Take the seven churches of Asia. In passing, we might notice that in Ephesus we have the second generation syndrome. In Thyatira you have the immorality and idolatry of the city. In Laodicea, you have the affluence of the city. And perhaps that's our chief danger. Then the question, what should we do to avoid being enslaved by these things? Well, what did Joshua do? Remember again Joshua 1 and 8. The Lord said to him, "This book of the law shall not depart out of thy mouth, that thou shalt meditate therein day and night, thou mayest observe to do according to all that is written therein, for then thou shalt make thy way prosperous, and then thou shalt have good success. Joshua obeyed, and he avoided the sins of the Canaanites. And remember too how Joshua in his old age gave the people of Israel the same exhortation, the same that God had given him. Chapter 23:6. He said, "Be ye therefore very courageous to keep and to do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, that ye turn not aside therefrom to the right hand or to the left." But the people disobeyed. And that accounts largely for the difference between Joshua and Judges. And I believe the word applies to us also, with one exception. It's no longer the book of the law. In Acts 20, Paul warns the elders of Ephesus concerning the dangers that lie ahead. And he said, "I commend you to God," not to the book of the law, "I commend you to God and to the word of his grace."